Okay, so let me begin by briefly reviewing some of the topics that I discussed yesterday, which I'll need today. So we gave a general formulation of D-brains in a space-time background. Okay. And what we said is that this is described by a boundary conformal field theory on the upper half plane, okay, which I will denote by BCFT. Okay. And furthermore, this factors into two parts. One is the boundary CFT of the matter fields, and then the boundary CFT of the ghost fields. Okay. And neither the interaction nor the boundary conditions couple matter and ghost, okay, at least for simple enough backgrounds. Okay. Then we introduced H, which is the vector space of states. In BCFT, okay, H splits again into two parts. Okay. Now we can define a ghost number in H. And the way we define ghost number by assigning ghost number to specific states and operators. So B and B bar, they have ghost number minus 1, C C bar have ghost number plus 1, matter fields have ghost number 0. Okay. It's visible. Okay, and then we have to assign the ghost number to one of the states. Okay, when we chose to assign the ghost number to the SL2R invariant state. And this has ghost number 0. And given this assignment, we can work out the ghost number of any state in H, because we simply have to, all states are created by applying on this SL2R invariant vacuum various operators made of B, C and the matter fields. Then we introduce the notion of vortex operator. Okay. For every state in H, okay, there exists a local boundary operator phi of x such that phi of 0 on the vacuum is the state phi, okay, and these will be referred to as the vortex operators. Okay. Then I said that this, there is a natural operator on this vector space H, which is a ghost number 1, which is a BRST charge. So QB is a ghost number 1 operator on H. I should have also said something else, okay, that here I introduce the notion that Hn is a subspace of H of H of Bose number n. So QB is a Ghost number 1 operator on H, and I should have said yesterday that QB involves both matter and ghost. Okay, so this is not made either purely of matter or purely of ghost. And the physical states, okay, this satisfies QB square equal to 0. And using the BRST chart, we can now define the physical states of the open string on the D-brain. Okay. These are states in H1 carrying ghost number 1. Satisfying two conditions. First of all, they have to be annihilated by the BRST charge. And second, given two such states, phi and phi prime, we will call phi and phi prime are equivalent if phi prime minus phi is QB lambda for some lambda in H naught. Okay. So physical states then are in one-to-one correspondence with elements of BRST cohomology. Non-trivial elements of BRST cohomology. Okay, so what you want to do today is to formulate a field theory of open strings, say open string field theory, which has certain properties. So we'll define an open string field theory to be a field theory such that the following two conditions hold. First of all, inequivalent solutions of linearized equations of motion should correspond to physical states of the open string. And the second condition is that the S matrix calculated using the Feynman rules must agree with the known S matrix. So this is calculated using Polyakov prescription. Which in turn involves integration over moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces with boundaries. Okay, so this then is the task that we have to perform, and then let's see how we go about doing it. Okay, so the first question that we need to address is, we know from this first requirement that what the inequivalent solutions of the linearized equations of motion of the field theory should correspond to. But we have to decide what a general field configuration corresponds to. A general field configuration, of course, should include these configurations, which are solutions of linearized equations of motion. But a general field configuration also includes configurations which are not solutions of equations of motion. Okay. So the question then is, what corresponds to a general field configuration? And the answer to this, there need not be a unique answer to this, because there may be different string field theories which satisfy these requirements. But the particular string field theory that I'll focus on, namely cubic string field theory, there the answer is quite simple. It's an arbitrary element phi belonging to H1. So an arbitrary state of Gauss number 1 in H. So that clearly should include these conditions, because after all, the physical states of the open string are elements in H1 satisfying certain constraints. So if a general string field configuration contains all elements of H1, or an arbitrary element of H1, that certainly will include these configurations. Elements in H1 satisfying these. Now the second question that we'll address, okay, perhaps I should say something else, that this is not the complete story. Okay. There is an additional restriction on phi, which is known as a reality condition. Okay. And this takes the form phi equal to phi c, okay, where this is some antilinear map in H1. But I'll not try to describe in detail what this map is. When I try to develop some intuitive notion of string field theory, I'll specify exactly what this antilinear map corresponds to. Okay. So this basically says that when we choose a basis in H1 and expand phi as in terms of that basis, the coefficients, okay, are either real or imaginary. Okay. They cannot be arbitrary complex number. And whether they are real or imaginary will be determined by this condition. Okay. So now, given the fact that a general string field configuration is an element of H1, okay, we need to now specify an action. Which I'll denote by S of phi. Okay. And as in any field theory, what the action should do, that given a field configuration, it should give you a number. Okay. That number is the value of the action for that field configuration. Okay. So this then is a map from H1 to the space of real numbers. Okay. And this action was first written down by Witten. So the action takes a simple form. So this is the action that we'll be working with. Okay. So I have to explain various terms which appear in the action. Okay. So let's start with G. G is just a real number. Okay. This is known as the open string coupling constant. QB I have already introduced. Okay. So QB on phi is just another state. It's an element of H2, okay, given any element of H1. Okay. I have to specify what this inner product means. So given two elements of H, in fact, this is defined in general for arbitrary elements in H. So AB belonging to H, okay. This is known as BPZ inner product. Okay. It's a non-degenerate inner product, and it's defined by in terms of a two-point correlation function on the upper half plane. Okay. So the definition of this is that it's so here, this notation, okay, simply means that this is the correlation function of BCFT on EA upper half plane. B of A and B are the vertex operators, A of X and B of X are the vortex operators associated with A and B. Okay. So B of 0 is just the vortex operator for B at put at the origin. Okay. This notation, okay, means the following. So first of all, I of Z is a conformal map. This is minus 1 over Z. So this is a conformal map. And finally, for any conformal map F, this notation means that this is the conformal transform of A of X by the map F. So in particular, if A of X is a primary vortex operator of weight H, then F dot A of X is simply F prime of X to the H A of Fx. If A of X is not primary, then there are extra terms. Yeah, I'm going to specify that. Yeah. In fact, the total Ghost number of A and B must be equal to 3. Okay, that's the property it satisfies. Okay. So it's a non-degenerate inner product, but this, for example, doesn't define an inner product in H1. Okay, because inner product of all states of H1 itself will be 0. Okay, so in particular then, that means that if we want to calculate what is I. Okay, so if A is a primary, okay, let's take this case, okay, then I dot A of X, okay, will be I is minus 1 over Z, so this is 1 over Z square to the power H, A, let's call it A of X, of minus 1 over X. Okay. And so I dot A of 0 is limit of X goes to 0, 1 over X square to the power H. Okay. But this correlation function always gives finite answer for when we use this definition. This is always a finite correlation function, even though it looks like there are some infinities here. And one way to see that this is a finite correlation function is that you can map the upper half plane back into the disk, unit disk, where of course inside the unit disk every point is finite and there are no infinities explicitly anyway. Okay, is this definition clear so far? Okay, so this has defined, so I have so far only defined the first term in the star product in the string field theory. Okay, because I have defined what BPG inner product is, so this term is now completely well defined. Okay, and now I have to define what this object is. Okay, so in particular I have to define what this state is, because this is again the standard BPG inner product. Yeah, basically, I mean, what one can show in this language that, okay, maybe that's the next point I was going to mention anyway. Okay. That if you have a correlation function of this form on the upper half plane, this correlation function is non-zero, okay, only if total Ghost number of the Y's equal to 3. Okay. And this follows from an anomaly in the Ghost number current. Okay, you can show that the Ghost number current has an anomaly, and you can evaluate that anomaly on the upper half plane or on the disk, and you find that the Ghost number is violated by this particular amount when you do the computation on the disk or the upper half plane, okay, which are conformally equivalent. If you do the same thing on other surfaces, for example, if you do the same thing on a sphere, then this answer will be 6. Okay, on a torus, okay, since there is no curvature on the torus, the answer is 0. And so on. Yeah, this is also the dimension of the automorphism, dimension of SL2R basically, okay, which is the automorphism group of the upper half plane. Pardon? Well, okay, I mean, there the point is you have to look at the number of zero modes. Okay, I mean, there you look at the automorphism group of punctured sphere. That's another way of looking at it. Okay, or maybe not, I shouldn't say it that way. You count the automorphism group and then you subtract the number of moduli. Okay, and that's what is related to the anomaly. Yeah. Okay, so then I have to now specify what the star product is. Well, what exactly do you mean by compatible?
Well, that's the question. I would have thought the operation would be skew symmetric.
Yeah, I'll write down the symmetry property of Q. But as defined, this is, I mean, perfectly well defined, right? I mean, you are asking what happens when you try to move Q to the on A instead of on B, right? And we'll write down relations what happens there. Okay, so given A and B belonging to H, again this is defined in general without reference to whether the ghost numbers of A and B. Okay. A star B is an element of H. Okay. So the star product is a map from H to H, but it also has a nice property under for the ghost number, okay, namely the ghost numbers just add. Okay. So if we restrict to HM and HN here, okay, it just gives a map to HM plus N. Okay, so the ghost number of A star B is just the ghost number of A plus ghost number of B. Now the way we'll define it, there are many ways to define it. I'll later give some intuitive definition of the star product, but if you want to give a formal definition of the star product in conformal field theory, the one way to do it is to simply specify how to calculate this object. Because the BPZ inner product is non-degenerate, so if you know how to calculate this for any state C, that completely defines the state A star B. Why is it non-degenerate? Okay, this is something you can show. Yeah, in a conformal field theory. Yeah. Okay. So if we calculate this, okay, the definition of this is the following. This is again given as a correlation function on the upper half plane. Okay. With certain maps, so F1 dot, okay, let me put the C first. Okay. Where, okay, this simply denotes the conformal transform of the vortex operator of C by F1, conformal transform of vortex operators of A by F2, and so on. Okay. This is on the upper half plane. Okay. Fi of z are conformal maps. I'll write them down soon. But it's also quite often convenient to rewrite this as a correlation function on a unit disk by simply mapping the upper half plane to the unit disk. Okay. So this can also be written as H1 dot C of 0 on the unit disk. So all I need to do now is to specify these maps H1, H2, and H3, okay, or equivalently F1, F2, and F3. Yeah.
Zero and the tap is on the boundary.
Okay. Yeah. No. The point is, see this. I mean, you are making a conformal transformation from the left. I mean, you are talking about this zero mapping to this. I mean, the point is the conformal transformation is acting from the left. Okay, so I'll explain what this corresponds to. Okay, what? So first let me define H1, H2, and H3. H1 is 1 plus IZ over 1 minus 2/3. H2, here it is. So the way we should view these maps, okay, is always either F1 or H1, is that let's take a unit disk, unit half disk on the upper half plane, okay, and you regard these maps, okay, this unit half disk of course includes the origin, okay, where you want to compute these maps, and you see what these maps H1, H2, and H3 do to this unit half disk on the inside the disk. So what H1 does is simply that it takes this unit half disk and maps it here. The origin here gets mapped to the the origin here gets mapped here. So this 0 refers to the origin of the unit half disk. Okay. Now, when you try to compute the FIs, okay, what you need to do is to, okay, I should see this is H1, okay, and then it's clear what H2 and H2 will do. Do H2 will map it here, and H3 will map it here. And then FI of Z, what it does is that you simply take this unit disk, okay, and then map it back to upper half plane. So you take the whole unit disk here, okay, map it to the upper half plane. So FI is G of HI of Z, where G is G of W. Is I times 1 minus W or 1 plus W. Okay. Okay. In the end, it doesn't matter what map you choose. Okay. Any map G which maps the unit disk back to the upper half plane will do, because the correlation functions are invariant under SL2R transformation on the upper half plane. Okay. So these arguments over here, okay, refer to the origin of the unit half disk. Okay. So you are either mapping the unit half disk into regions of the unit disk, Okay. Or you are mapping the unit half disk into regions of the upper half plane. Is this point clear, or should I repeat it again? Okay. See, let's recall the definition of f dot phi, f dot a. Okay. So what f dot a of x does, okay, let's take a equal to primary. This is f prime of x to the h times a of f of x. Okay, this is the definition of f dot a of x. So this x refers to the coordinate on the unit half disk. Okay. This f either takes the unit half disk into a region of the upper half plane, or into a region of the unit disk, or any other representation of the disk that you like. Okay. So the x equal to 0 always remains x equal to 0. Okay. If you use this map, okay, here x equal to 0, so these are the points h1 of 0, h2 of 0, and h3 of 0. Okay. And then the further map g will take you h1 of 0 into some point on the real axis, this into some point on the real axis, and this into some point on the real axis. Is this okay? So since we know how to compute the correlation functions in the conformal field theory, okay, on the upper half plane or in the unit disk, okay, you can use either of these two descriptions. Okay. And given three vortex operators A, B, and C, okay, both these prescriptions just give a number, okay, the same number. Whether you calculate this on the unit disk or on the upper half plane, it doesn't matter, okay, because of the conformal invariance of the theory. Okay. So this procedure gives a number for every set of three states A, B, and C. Okay. And given this, that completely defines the state A star B, because the inner product is non-degenerate. Is this point clear? Yeah, I'll give now Witten's definition, which is more intuitive. Okay. But if you want to, make sense of it rigorously, you have to either decompose it, use oscillator description, or use the conformal field theory description. But you have to use oscillator. Yeah. See, the point is, because there is no natural inner product in H1, right, you cannot ask whether the norm of the final state is finite or not. Right? Suppose you take two states, A and B, right, which are a finite linear combination of oscillator states. Okay? The star product is not a finite linear combination of oscillator states, right? But you cannot decide whether but each coefficient is finite. Right? And you cannot decide whether it's good or not, because there is no natural norm. Yeah, it's equal to his. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly equal to his. Just an alternative way of defining the product.
It's clear that your action is defined, but it's not so clear that you've defined
the product. That I have defined it. No, see, this defines a product. Right? Because since the inner product is non-degenerate.
The product, but from one space to another space, not within the one space. That's what we're saying. It maps from, let's say, smooth function.
Okay, see, here we have not talked about functions or distributions. We have, that's it, yeah. See, it certainly converts a finite oscillator sum into infinite oscillator sum. Yeah.
So
Yeah, the axiom certainly includes only these. Yeah. So the axiom is certainly well defined for any. Yeah, I think that's true.
It's not clear what that means right now, but what I said is
really. Okay. So let me now write down certain identities involving the Q and the star, okay, without giving the proofs, but then I'll also try to give an intuitive definition of these products. Okay. But what we can see from here, okay, so now, okay, now the reason that this map is, this picture is useful, okay, is normally one thinks of the open string as lying along this semicircle. Okay, because this is the picture in the upper half plane. When you make the exponential map, this just becomes a straight line. So when you go from here to the strip, by, if this is z and this is y, you write, if you go to the strip using y equal to log z, then this semicircle simply becomes this line. So one thinks of this semicircle as the open string. Okay. So you can see that what these maps do, okay, it, that it takes for the first state, it maps the open string along this line, okay, because this is what goes into this line over here, the point I goes over here. Okay. So the first open string, okay, this one gets mapped here, the second open string gets mapped here, and the third open string gets mapped here. Okay. So it's as if the second half of the first open string is coinciding with the first half of the second open string. The first half of the second open string coincides with the second half of the first open string, and so on. Okay. So it's, I mean, they are cyclically overlapped on each other. And this picture can also be given a more intuitive definition using the path integral language, using the functional language, okay, which I'll describe later. Okay. Yes, this. Now, what one can show is that these three satisfy the following set of identities. Okay. First identity I have already written down earlier, which is qb square equal to 0. Okay. Then the second identity says that if you take the inner product of qb with b, this is given by minus of minus 1 to the n a with qbb, okay, where n a is the ghost number of a. Okay. The third identity says that qb on a star b is qb a star b plus Okay. So QB basically distributes over the star product. So these are the three properties that involve the BRST charge. The other properties don't involve the BRST charge. So this says that this product is cyclic, okay. And finally this is the associativity of the star product. Okay. And you can prove these identities, okay, using the conformal field theory techniques, provided the total central charge is equal to zero. Is needed in the proof based on conformal field theory. Okay. Which in this case is true, because we saw that the total central charge is minus 26 from the ghost and 26 from the matter, which indeed is zero. Basically oscillator states. I mean, if you have finite number of oscillators acting, I mean, if it's a finite linear combination of, oscillator states, right? Or say, Virasoro generators acting on the finite set of Virasoro generators acting on the state, then you can prove this.
Okay, but as you pointed out, that the star product is not closed under that
state. Yeah. Yeah, so I'll write down the intuitive definition of star product, and then it will become clear why it's associative.
Okay.
So I'll just write. So these are the identities, and now I'll write down the intuitive definition of the star product. But I mean, you can, for example, you can prove associativity using that intuitive definition, okay, without any restriction to the central charge. Okay. But again, I mean that intuitive notion you should only treat as a guideline. Okay, and not use it seriously. You either use, specific oscillator representation of the star product, or use the conformal field theory representation, and then you discover all the constraints that come in. Okay, so here is the intuitive definition of a star as well as the BPZ inner product. Okay. So let's denote by phi, okay, collectively all the what I'll call coordinate fields. Of the CFT. Okay. So, for example, for flat space time, this set phi will involve all the coordinates x0, x1, up to x 25, and then ghosts. Okay. But you have to be somewhat careful about the ghosts, because since ghosts have action which is linear, okay, B bar, C and C bar are not all coordinate fields. Okay, half of them are momentum and half of them are coordinates. Okay, so you pick which half you want to describe, take as your coordinates, and you include those in the list. Okay, so in particular, you can use C and C bar, for example. But it doesn't matter which you pick. Okay, this is just an intuitive notion of what constitutes coordinate fields. Okay, because as in ordinary quantum mechanics, where states are represented as wave functions, okay, what you are going to do is to represent the string state, okay, a state of the string, as a wave function of these fields, or a wave functional of these fields. Okay. So given any open string state A, there is an associated wave functional which I'll denote by F A of phi of sigma. Okay, where sigma runs from 0 to pi. Okay. And the idea is that just like in the case of quantum mechanics, we represent functions as wave functions of the coordinates. Okay, here, a coordinate of the open string is a functional, okay, because it tells you a whole set of functions. So in particular, if you consider ordinary open string moving in flat space-time, okay, you think of the coordinates as functions x0, x1, x2 of the sigma. Okay, of the so sigma is a coordinate which basically labels the along the which labels the open string. Okay, and a given state of the string is described by a functional of these fields, of these objects. Is this notion clear? Now, first of all, in this interpretation, it's easy to write down the reality condition that I talked about earlier. Okay, so let me do that first. So the reality condition, okay, is basically that the complex conjugate of FA should be the same as FA of phi, pi minus sigma. The BPZ inner product.
Sorry, is there motivation for that condition?
Yeah, it's something like, I mean, hermeticity of F. If you regard F as a matrix, okay, labeled by, say, the half of this string and half of that string, instead of regarding F as a functional of the full string coordinate, okay, you can think of F as labeled by two sets of functions, okay, one which is phi of sigma for sigma less than pi by 2, and one for phi of sigma for sigma larger than pi by 2. Okay. Then FA is like phi left of sigma, phi right of sigma, okay, where phi left of sigma corresponds to phi of sigma for sigma less than pi by 2, and phi right of sigma correspond to phi of sigma for sigma greater than pi by, sorry, phi of pi minus sigma for sigma greater than pi by 2. Okay. And in that language, this is now like a matrix. okay, with rho indices phi l of sigma and column index phi r of sigma, and this is the hermeticity condition of the matrix. I don't know. Is there any intuitive notion that one can give why this is the reality? Pardon? Well, yeah, star product is a matrix product. I mean, if you use this intuitive notion, then the star product is becomes a matrix product. Okay, so it's so from that point of view, it's natural to regard these as matrices. Okay, and I mean, then you use this hermeticity condition. And okay, I mean, the practical reason why you have to impose this is that we can now expand the string field in components. Okay, and you see that if you recover the correct reality condition on the fields. Okay, in particular, when you write down the action in terms of components, you have to make sure that the kinetic terms come with positive sign. Okay. And if you multiply a field by I, right, since the BPZ inner product is linear, is bilinear, you'll get an extra factor of minus 1. So unless you choose your factors of I and 1 properly, you will get wrong sign for the kinetic term. Okay. And this choice gives the right choice of the kinetic term. So that's the practical reason why you want to impose this reality condition. I mean, it's like if you have a gauge field, and if you simply gauge field action, and if you simply multiply the gauge field by I and call it a new gauge field, then you'll get a wrong sign for the action. Well, closed string field theory is not very well understood, but at least at this level, that is, one can write down a similar condition for closed strings, okay, which is a little bit more complicated. Okay, so the BPZ inner product between two states is given by integral . So what this does is that it identifies the left half of the first string, okay, with the right half of the second string and vice versa. Okay. Because it this is fine. Okay. You take the convolution of the product of FA and FB, okay, integrate over, this is a functional integral over phi of sigma. Okay. You imagine that you have split the sigma interval into many small into a lattice, and you integrate over each point. Okay, that is how you define a functional integral, and then you simply multiply this. Okay, so this corresponds to if this is the string A, and this is the string B. Okay, it's simply identifying A with B in opposite direction. And finally, the star product . Okay, so this is a new functional, okay, which should be produced from a functional FA of phi and FB of phi, and the definition is the following. So these are just delta functions. Okay, again you imagine that you have split up the sigma coordinate, the 0 to pi length into small lattice, into lattice, okay, and you integrate over each lattice point. Okay, that's the way you can interpret this. Okay. And so you see that from here, okay, what it's doing is that this product runs from sigma equal to 0 to pi by 2. Okay. So it identifies, okay, phi of sigma for 0 from 0 to pi by 2 to phi 1 of sigma. Okay. Then phi of sigma from pi by 2 to pi, it identifies with phi 2 of sigma from pi by 2 to pi. Okay. And then finally, it identifies the rest of phi 1 with the rest of phi 2. Okay. So intuitively, the picture then is that if we have string A, B, if this is A, this is B, and this is C, okay, it's identifying, okay, half of A with half of B, half of B with half of C, and half of C with half of A. Okay, that's this delta function doing. And if you use this definition of the star product, okay, it's easy to see that star product is associative. Okay. Because to get the string D, okay, if you want to calculate A star B star C, okay, with D, for example, okay, or A star B star C with D, okay, it doesn't matter which way you combine them. You will have to, I mean, the resulting diagram is always like this. We have A, B, C, and D. Okay. Whether you first compute A star B and then compose it with psi or with C, or first compute B star C and then compose with A, you always get the same string at the end. Okay. Formally, you just use this definition. Okay, and repeat it twice to calculate A star B star C and A star B star C. Okay, and you will get exactly the same answer. Okay, by formally manipulating these delta functions. But as I said, those formal manipulations, of course, have to be, justified using other rigorous oscillator expression or conformal field theory expression or conformal field theory techniques. And that certainly gives constraints on what conformal field theory you should have. That this equals what we wrote down earlier. Well, see, this definition itself is somewhat ambiguous, right? You have to regularize this to, make this well defined. Yeah. See, you have a product of sigma, right? And so, you can probably define this for, any conformal field theory that you like. Okay, the point is, that's right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But see, the point is, when you, yeah, yeah. But see, what happens there is that when you make this, okay, see, each string is flat, right? So if you join strings this way, okay, what you get is a surface where the total angle here is 4 pi, because each of these angles is pi, right? Now, to map it into the standard, correlation function on the plane, you have to make a conformal transformation, okay, to smoothen out this singularity, okay? And that conformal transformation, okay, can have extra anomaly, right, in going from this 4 pi angle to 2 pi angle. And those anomalies cancel if the conformal, if the central charge is 0, okay? That's one way of seeing why, where this thing requires C equal to 26. Okay, so let me now say what is the use of all these identities. Okay, I wrote down several identities. The use is that using these identities, one can get some nice results. Okay, maybe I should also say something more here which will make this well motivated. We can see that the action that is written down there is very similar to the action of a three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory. So let me write down this analogy, 3D Chern-Simons theory. So the action for a three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory, just abelian Chern-Simons theory for the time. Okay, it doesn't matter if it's abelian or not. In fact, okay, let's consider non-abelian Chern-Simons. Okay. So this is some three manifold. And then we have A is a one form, okay, valued in some algebra. Okay. So this is the action for three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory, and this action has an invariance 0 if we take delta A equal to d lambda plus A wedge lambda minus lambda wedge A. Okay, where lambda is a 0 form. Okay. Now, I have erased the identities. One can check that the identities that Q star and the BPZ inner product satisfies, they are very similar to the identities that the wedge product and D and integration satisfies, okay, provided we identify, okay, D with QB, okay, Gauss number with degree of the form. Wedge product with star product, okay, and integral A wedge B with BPZ inner product. Okay, if we just make these replacements, okay, one will see that the identities that are satisfied by the differential operator D, okay, the wedge product, okay, and the integration are exactly similar to the identities that Q satisfies with the star product and the BPZ inner product. Okay, it's not necessary to keep this analogy in mind, but it's useful, helpful. Anyway, so what one can show is that if we take the delta S vanishes under the following variation. Where lambda is some element of H, 0. And this transformation is exactly analogous to the gauge transformation in Chern-Simons theory. And the reason that the delta S is 0, okay, under this variation, okay, is the same reason why the Chern-Simons action is doesn't vary under this variation. Okay. So this we identify, okay, interpret as a gauge symmetry of string theory. String field theory. Okay. So which means that we will treat all fields which differ in this way to be equivalent field configurations. Now, if we look at the linearized gauge transformations, okay, which means that you only pick up terms on the left hand side, okay, which survive as phi goes to 0. And you can see that this starts looking very similar to the identification that we have for physical open string states. Okay, but we'll see this more clearly soon. Okay, because so far phi is just some arbitrary state. Okay, we also have to see where the condition on phi is coming from. The fact that phi should be BRST invariant is coming from, and that comes from looking at the equations of motion. So the equation of motion is derived using the same action principle as usual in a normal field theory. So we said delta is equal to 0 under an arbitrary variation of delta phi. And using that the BPZ inner product is non-degenerate, one can derive the equation of motion as QB phi plus phi star phi equal to 0. Okay. So again, then the solution of linearized equations of motion, or just linearized equation of motion, gives QB phi equal to 0. And now we see then that this string field theory does have the right property, that the inequivalent solutions of the linearized equations of motion are precisely members of the BRST cohomology. Okay. The linearized equation of motion tells us that QB must annihilate phi, and the gauge equivalence tells us that if two such solutions differ by QB on lambda, we must identify them. So solutions of correspond to BRST cohomology. Okay, so this was one of the requirements on string field theory, and this string field theory certainly does satisfy that requirement. Okay. But this of course is not sufficient, because if we only require this, okay, then we could have just dropped this term, for example. Okay. Because if we just take the quadratic term, okay, it would still be gauge invariant to include all the nonlinear terms in the gauge terms in the gauge transformation. This term is needed, okay, to produce the correct S matrix. Okay, so that's the next statement, which I'll not prove certainly. Okay. So one can show that S of phi reproduces the correct S matrix. Okay. And this is why this string field theory is a good description of open string theory, okay, as we know string theory. Yeah.
And yet you said one doesn't understand a string field theory for closed string.
Yeah.
And yet you make this step. So what happens to the closed string and the open string theory?
Yeah. See, what happens is that when you look at the S matrix, okay, you calculate S matrix with external open string states, okay, because you are using perturbation theory. What you find is that S matrix automatically includes the closed string exchange poles, as it should, because open strings, I mean, S matrix should contain closed string exchange poles. So in that sense, it does contain closed strings. But closed strings are not there as explicit fields in this theory. Steve, you want to say something? That's right, exactly. Yeah. So this gives a complete cover of the moduli space of punctured Riemann surfaces, provided the punctures are on the boundary.
And there is
a That's right. Okay. Now, since we are ultimately interested in studying solutions of the equations of motion, okay, let's try to see how, I mean, study some general properties of solutions of equations of motion. Okay. So suppose phi naught denotes a solution of the equations of motion, which means that phi naught satisfies the equation QB phi naught plus phi naught star phi naught equal to 0. Okay. Now, given this solution, we can try to expand the string field action not around phi equal to 0 as we have done there, but around phi equal to phi naught. Okay. What this means is that we define a new shifted string field psi, which is phi minus phi naught, okay, and try to rewrite S in terms of psi. Okay. So S of phi will now be written as S of phi naught plus psi. Okay. And when we expand this in powers of psi, first of all you get a constant term, which is this S of phi naught. Okay. Now the linear term in psi should vanish because phi naught is an extremum. Okay. Delta S is 0, okay, at phi naught, that's what this relation tells you. So the linear term should vanish. There is a quadratic term and then there is a cubic term. So let me write this as S tilde of psi. And what one can show is that S tilde of psi has the following structure. Okay, I'll explain what this Q is. This is the only new object which has appeared here. Okay. Now, first of all, it's clear that the cubic term is not going to change under a shift. Okay. The psi cube term is going to come from the phi cube term. Okay. So, this structure remains exactly the same. The quadratic term is going to shift. Yeah. Why there is no term on? See, that's that Q I haven't defined yet. Right? Q is not Q, the QB. Okay. So Q is defined. Okay. So at this stage, okay, to define the action over here, where did that action go? Oh, here. Well, I think I brought out the wrong board. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, see, at this point, Q has to be defined only on Gauss number 1 states, right? Because psi, after all, is a Gauss number 1 state. Okay. But what I will do is to now give a general definition of Q on arbitrary Gauss number state, okay, which, when restricted to Gauss number 1 state, reproduces the correct answer. So, Q on A is defined to be QB on A plus phi naught star A minus 1 to the NA A star phi naught. It's just a straightforward exercise to show that if we expand S of phi this way, then the quadratic term in psi contains the original QB, but then there are extra terms which are given by this. So for NA equal to 1, which is a case of interest, QB Q psi is simply QB psi. And these two terms are the same. They have the same sign. Okay. But there is a reason why one defines Q in general. Okay, because Q defined this way satisfies some nice properties. Okay. So Q can be shown to satisfy just by knowing the properties of the star product and the BRST charge and BPZ inner product that I wrote down, okay, without knowing anything in detail about what star product is and what QB is and so on. Okay. Q can be shown to satisfy, first of all, that Q square is 0. Okay. Then QA with B is minus 1 to the NA. With QB, okay, and Q on A star B is Q on A. And you will notice that these properties are exactly the same properties that QB satisfied. Okay. but here QB has been replaced by Q. And this requires defining Q in this specific fashion, okay, with this minus 1 to the NA term in here, okay, and these relations hold acting on irrespective of what the host numbers of A and B are. Now, given that Q satisfies a relation of this form, we can easily conclude that this S tilde of psi that we have written down here has a gauge invariance. Right? The same kind of gauge invariance that S of phi, the original action, had, can be now be restated for S tilde of psi, okay? Because after all, these are the only relations that are used for deriving the gauge invariance. Okay? These plus the relations involving the star product and the BPZ inner product, which haven't changed. So the gauge invariance says that delta S tilde of psi equal to 0 under a delta psi, which is of the form Q lambda plus psi star lambda minus lambda star psi. And we can also write down the equations of motion. Which is simply Q psi plus psi star psi equal to 0. Now, I should just say at this stage that it's not that this is a new gauge invariance and we are deriving new equations of motion. After all, we could have derived the equations of motion and gauge invariance in terms of phi, okay, and simply made this shift. Okay. But just by rewriting the action in this form, we have made this manifest, okay, the gauge invariance and the equations of motion. We can now forget about S of phi, just to work with S tilde of psi, okay, if we want to study the theory in terms of psi rather than phi.
What about the property
of Q A? Yeah, that's this property. Okay, see, the point is you don't need for gauge invariance that integral of Q A is 0. Okay, what you need is this, that you should be able to do integration by parts. You do have?
You do have this property for the pair of
scalars. Yeah, but you don't need it for proving gauge invariance.
No, my question is whether you shift to the new Q, you still have the property.
Formally, you still have that property. Okay, it depends on what your phi naught is. Okay, I mean, if the phi naught is sufficient low LBF, then you, I mean, still have that property. Okay, just by associativity of the star product and the cyclicity property of the star product. So now, given these equations of motion and gauge invariance, we can start studying linearized fluctuation around psi equal to 0, which means around phi equal to phi naught. Okay. So suppose you want to study small fluctuations around phi equal to phi naught, okay, which corresponds to psi equal to 0. Okay. So the linearized equations then are Q on psi equal to 0, okay, and gauge invariance is delta psi equal to Q on lambda. And this then shows that the solution, the inequivalent solutions of linearized equations of motion, okay, around psi equal to 0 are in one-to-one correspondence with the cohomology of Q. So this means that linearized around psi equal to 0, modulo gauge invariance corresponds to cohomology of Q. Okay. And these we can interpret as physical open string states around psi equal to 0, okay, or phi equal to phi naught. Because the solutions of linearized equations of motion are in one-to-one correspondence with the physical excitations. Okay. So what I'll do now is to restate, okay, all the tachyon condensation conjectures that I stated yesterday in this language, in the language of string field theory, and then next time we will see how to go about verifying them. Are there any questions at this point? So here is then a statement of conjecture 1. Okay. Conjecture 1 in the language of tachyon said that there should be a solution of the equations of motion, okay, local minimum, where the total energy density vanishes. Okay. So in the language of string field theory, okay, the conjecture 1 will say that there exists a solution phi naught belonging to H1. Okay. First of all, it should be a solution of the equations of motion. Okay. Such that the following condition holds. Okay. I should say, probably I should have added also here that this solution should be static, okay, and also space time independent, because after all you are looking for a vacuum like solution. Okay. So static translation invariant. Such that the following condition holds. Okay. This will now be a condition on the action, because in string field theory we haven't talked about potential, we have only introduced the action. Okay. So what should be the conjectured value of the action? Okay. The conjectured value of the action can be worked out by going back to the field theory language, and let's see in terms of the tachyon what we expect for the action to be. So, in the field theory language, the action is integral dp plus 1x, if you are looking on a dp plane, okay, times V. For static configuration, the action is just this. There is no kinetic term contribution. So, it is this, okay, V of T. Okay. This was conjectured to be minus the tension of the plane. Okay. And because the solution is independent of space and time, this object here, okay, I write as minus the volume of space time, okay, or volume of the direction tangential to the dbrand, so Vp plus 1. So the conjecture answer of A sub phi naught then is that this should be equal to V of P plus 1 times Tp, okay, where this is the dbrand, dp brand y volume. Is this point here? If it is a non-compact space time, then this is infinite, okay, but this is just a trivial infinity which can be taken care of. One way to deal with this is to simply imagine that all directions tangential to the D plane are compact, okay, in which case it will be just a finite volume. The second conjecture which is the conjecture that there are no physical open string excitations around this vacuum, okay, is simply a statement that the cohomology of Q should vanish, okay, because after all the cohomology of Q corresponds to physical open string states around phi naught.
The main conjecture was that that was a minimum.
Yeah, okay, in this case we cannot really specify that is a minimum, it is a saddle point. I mean, all we consider this is the saddle point, but when you do the numerical analysis, and if you, if you eliminate the auxiliary fields, okay, you do find that it is a minimum. Okay. See, because here, I mean, in string field theory, there are many fields, right? Some of them are like auxiliary fields. And we know that in field theory, the auxiliary fields can have maximum and which still corresponds to actually minimum of the potential after we eliminate the auxiliary fields. So, what we can do in string field theory is we can eliminate all the heavy fields, okay, and write down an effective potential in terms of the tachyon. It is not a very efficient way of doing things, but if you do that, then you do find that it's a local minimum.
Yeah. Actually, with regard to the translationally invariant part, if you start with a general E-brain and then go to the vacuum, then the shift is translationally non-invariant, and it applies everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one way to tackle this, okay, which is in a general conformal field theory. Suppose you want to deal with a general field, D-brain, okay. Then, of course, even the tension depends on, I mean, the spatial coordinate, right? As you move along the D-brain, the tension may differ, okay, if it is in a complicated background. Okay. So, what to do is that you imagine that as if the directions tangential to the D-brain are compact. Okay, you can think of non-compact D-brains as a limit of compact D-brain. And then you can work only in terms of the mass of the D-brain. Okay, you can make this statement, okay, not in terms of tension, but purely in terms of the mass. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the statement is still valid.
Yeah, but phi zero itself
would
not be translated.
Yeah, then it will not be translated. So this statement is true for the the normal 25 brand, not D25, for any DP brand, because this is translation invariant in the PE direction tangential to the D brand. Yeah. Okay, but you can deal with the general curved D brand provided you simply work in terms of mass and not in terms of tension. So the conjecture 2 will say that Q, okay, defined as follows. Should have okay, which this means precisely that all solutions of q lambda equal to 0, all solutions of q psi equal to 0 are of the form and
do you really require the cohomology to vanish in all the sectors of different Hooke's numbers, or do you need only the Hooke's number equal to one sector?
Yeah, so if we just want absence of physical open string states, okay, then we want the cohomology to vanish only in the Hooke's number one sector. Okay, but at least all the evidence that one has found so far, it seems that the cohomology actually vanishes also in other Gauss number sectors. Okay, but that's not required for this conjecture. Okay, that as long as the cohomology vanishes in the Gauss number one sector, that means there are no physical open string states. And finally, the third part of the conjecture is the existence of other solutions which represent lower dimensional dibrands. This is conjecture 3. This is, if we start from a DP brand, we should get all solutions representing lower dimensional brands. Okay. And these solutions should have the property that they have the right tension of the D brand, of the DP minus K brand. Okay. So, which means that if you calculate that action, S of phi k, okay, and measure this action with respect to the vacuum action, okay, which means that you have to subtract off the action for phi naught. Okay. This should be simply minus the volume of the dP minus k brand times the tension of the p minus k brand. So this is the wall volume of d p minus k brand. Okay. Again, this relation comes because the action measured with respect to the vacuum is just the tension times the integration over the space-time volume, which gives d p minus k plus 1. Okay. This is the space-time volume of the p minus k brand. Then it's dp plus 1. Okay, yeah, maybe this is, I should. Something is wrong here. No, no, okay. Yeah, maybe this phi naught is not a good notation. See, the phi naught denotes the vacuum, right? Not the dP brand. Okay, so I should have, shouldn't have probably used this index k. Yeah, the phi naught is not, phi naught is a vacuum solution. Okay, so this is, we have already made the conjectures about the vacuum. So this is the, this is true for k larger than 1. Okay. So then these are the three conjectures so you'd like to check using string field theory. So what I'll do next time is to show how you can approach this problem numerically, okay, in string field theory and try to verify each of these three conjectures. And then in the last lecture, I'll describe some of the analytic approach to this problem. So I think I'll stop. Yeah.
If I have states A and B of ghost numbers little a and little b, what's the ghost number of A times A star b?
A plus b.
A plus b?
Yeah.
And which, so if I take the bare Q, Q sub b, and take its cohomology, which ghost numbers does it have non-trivial cohomology for?
It has non-trivial cohomology for ghost number 1, and I think it also has non-trivial cohomology for ghost number 2. Just the, because they are just dual two, dual of each other, 1 and 2. Yeah, they are the only two. One state, the vacuum. I mean, okay, probably, yeah.
Just like a 2 minute.
Yes.
Okay. And I should have probably said that Q also has the same ghost number. Yeah, Q changes the ghost number by 1 because psi naught has ghost number 1. So you know, take the Q contains QB piece and star product to psi naught, phi naught. So it just adds up the ghost number by 1.